shares,
the market,
the S&P, the ASX
stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that tries to keep its ego in check, but damn, that is hard when you are this good.
Oh, dear.
I'm Andrew Page, and with me is Scott Phillips.
G'day, Andrew. G'day, fools. When Andrew says this good, he's talking about himself. I'm the more humble of the two.
But you can't fight the facts, is all I can tell you.
Can't fight the moonlight either, but that's a Leanne Ryan story we're not going to go into.
That's different altogether.
Indeed.
What are we going to talk about today? A whole bunch of stuff. We thought that we would talk a bit about war and what is it good for, specifically in relation to Trump and China. It's back in the news again. We also are going to have a look at the various sporting codes in the country and look at that through the lens of money, as Ooh. In which code makes the most money and why, and what kind of value can be extracted there. Also, ethics in investing, something that's gaining a little bit of ground in recent years.
It is.
Does it matter?
And specifically recently with one particular social media scandal.
Exactly. So we'll definitely dive into that. We'll do a bit of mailbag too, and I think it's my turn to jump on the old high horse.
Oh, God.
Looking forward to that. So first, let's talk about Mr. Trump. He's threatened China with a trade war. Now, what more recently, just overnight, in fact, he said $60 billion worth of tariffs, 25% tariff. You've been stealing our intellectual property. We're going to do a bit of a tit for tat. And the reason, well, I guess there's a whole bunch of reasons why that's important. The immediate reaction was a 300-point plunge on the Dow Jones.
Indeed.
And our market hasn't opened yet as we go to where, but I'm going to go out there and say that the Aussie market's probably not going to react too well to that.
So just put that in context, the Dow closed off 2.9% overnight.
That's let's call it 3% on year enough. You don't often see those kinds of falls in a single day.
No, sir.
So the market is understandably quite worried.
Yep.
And I guess it's worried because not only in terms of what has been threatened, but the potential for this to escalate.
Yep.
So then China goes, well, if you're going to do that, we're going to do this. And then Trump goes, well, if you're going to do that, we're going to do this. And it goes on and on and on.
That's what you want. You want to be stuck between two knuckleheads having an argument.
Yeah.
That's a good place
to be. That's really, and frankly, the world's number one and two economies as well. So there is going to be potentially a whole bunch of collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
And poor little Australia, and we are very, very little in the grand scheme of things.
We really are.
What is it, 2% of the global economy?
I don't know about 2% of the global stock market anyway. I know that's true.
Right.
I think we're probably slightly smaller in terms of global economy size.
So even less. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and given that the US is an important trading partner and China is a very important trade partner.
What could possibly go wrong?
Mate, what do you think? Where's this going to go?
Oh, man, I mean, I've ranted on tariffs and Trump before, and I don't.
It's only a couple of weeks ago we talked a bit about it.
So you want me to do it again?
Why not? One trick pony.
So, and I will say again, our listeners will have seen the market response by the time they get this, but our market in the futures looked like off about 1.5-2%.
Yeah.
It's going to be messy on the ASX today. Look, here's the thing. I think there's a short-term, long-term problem going on here. It's very, very easy to say that by raising tariffs, you stop the bad stuff happening, and that's probably actually true to some degree. I will say for as much disdain as I have for Donald Trump's economic policy, separate the politics from the policy, I think the policy is very, very regressive. We're going back to the 50s and 60s. The last 50 years of economic growth globally has come from a lowering of tariff barriers. That is just unquestionably true. Mm-hmm. The increase in standard of living over the last half century is phenomenal. Think 50 years back. Think about the things we were using, the prices we were paying. Mm-hmm. I read something the other day, and this was on a housing topic, but I won't ask you to talk about housing, Andrew, or we'll run out of time on the podcast.
Did someone say housing?
No. The price of the average house deposit now was apparently back in 30 years ago was the equivalent of a couple of flights to London. Now it's equivalent of 140 flights to London because the price of flights has fallen so incredibly far. Mm. So the story of the last 50 years, not only just increasing in real wage or nominal wages on a per hour basis, but how bloody cheap everything has become because we're trading off our respective competitive advantages. And that's what we talked about when we talked about it a couple of weeks ago. So take it back a step. Putting up trade barriers just makes everything more expensive for everybody. Mm. If you put a tariff on China's imports into US, those prices go up. Mm. So the average American can buy less of them. And somehow that's supposed to protect things. Now, in the short term, it probably does. Mm. It probably gives the average manufacturing company in the US an extra couple of years worth of lifeline. It's easy to say, hey, I'm saving jobs. That's absolutely all true on a very specific basis. But on an economic basis, if we had to go back to the 1970s and drive the quality of car we had with the quality of manufacturing we had, the expensive TVs we had to buy, all of that stuff, we'd be saving a couple hundred thousand jobs, which are now, by the way, gone somewhere else. Now, total employment workforce has grown dramatically. Mm. But we'd have terrible stuff and we'd be paying a high price for it. it's a short-term sugar hit, and it feels good, and frankly, it's probably electorally popular because, hey, saving jobs, who doesn't want that? It's costing Americans an absolute truckload of cash over the next 4 or 5 years if they stay in place, because they're paying more for the stuff they're buying. Makes them less you know, effective in a competitive sense. It's just generally bad all round.
Okay, so we kind of covered that ground already, but I guess where I wanted to sort of dig into this is
is that code for we're going to cut this from the podcast later?
Yeah, if we can.
Boring.
Yeah, make a note. But, you know, it's all about me at the end of the day. And
which just very quickly, is that exactly why this policy is going to be electorally popular, by the way?
Because people are like,
yeah,
yes.
Economics, blah, 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 blah. Is my job safer? Yes.
Yes.
That, great. That, then I'll vote for you.
Or is the perception that my job is safer?
Right.
Which probably even more importantly.
Correct.
But let's look at things from an Aussie perspective.
Yeah,
we're on the sidelines here.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get dragged in the middle of it, but we're not going to have much say about it. That's the problem.
How does the Aussie economy, let's say that they do, let's say that the US massively increases tariff barriers for Chinese imports.
Yep.
China retaliates and does the same thing. Are we going to have to choose sides? Because there are all kinds of geopolitical considerations there as well. Or do these two big dogs just sort of keep it amongst themselves, or do other people inexorably get dragged in?
So you just said, let's not talk about big, scary geopolitical issues. Let's talk about bigger, scary geopolitical issues.
But how it relates back to me.
This is my wheelhouse. Oh, okay.
And then I'm going to ask you, just as a heads up, I'm going to ask you what stocks on the Aussie market are going to get impacted.
So look, I think here's the thing. I think, honestly, again, in the short term, we probably slightly benefit from this, because if Chinese steel is more expensive in the US, for example, then Australian steel, by comparison, relatively to that Chinese steel, actually becomes a little bit cheaper. And so, and also, we've been given a window from Trump about our exports into the US. So to some degree, in the short term, we probably actually benefit even slightly because of that.
Okay.
The bigger issue is it's going to really chill the winds of global trade, and that will impact absolutely everybody. So when you start to see a change in how those things work and how they... If China doesn't grow as fast, guess where all of our iron ore goes?
Yeah.
Guess where most of our industrial commodities go? The Australian impact, frankly, of this, if the Chinese economy is harmed by it, and it probably
will
be. Almost
certainly will be.
Exactly. It is a reduction in demand for the stuff we make, the stuff we produce. And that's not, by the way, just iron ore. Think about the growth in Chinese tourism in Australia. I think it's 20-odd% a year it's growing at the moment. You'd reduce that because the Chinese economy doesn't grow quite as fast. There is really significant across the economy impacts when it comes to our relationship with China and the trade value we get from that. Our exposure to the US actually is not anywhere near as much, because we don't send many of our raw commodities to the US. So it's not so much an American impact directly, but they may well cause a chilling of the world economy. If that happens, as a net exporter, as a country that exports a lot of our primary commodities in particular, we really have a bit to lose.
So if I was looking at all of this, and I'm an active ASX investor, and I'm trying to sort of see, you know, trying to work an angle here. How can, again, it's all about me. How can I profit, or at least protect my downside as an Aussie investor?
I have to say, my general view is I would look straight through this. I think, you know, Trump's in power for another 3, maybe 7 years if we're incredibly unlucky. And again, I speak policy rather than
although we've got a bet on the sidelines that it could be a lot longer than that.
Should we go into that?
No.
Okay.
Because I stand to lose a lot of
money. I'll ask you about that later. I will get back to that, listeners. Don't worry. Stay tuned. We will ask Andrew about that at the end of the podcast. So here's the thing. I look through it. I think there's going to be changes in tariff policy over time. The biggest risk is this becomes a global multi-decade chilling of trade policy, because other future presidents or potentially the president of China won't step away from this stuff, and it takes a while to get de-escalated. But I would look through it and say I wouldn't bother. In the short term, if you were worried about it, particularly in terms of volatility in your portfolio, the answer is probably to stick with companies that aren't export or import exposed. By that I mean you don't want to invest in a company that's doing business with the rest of the world, or who is being impacted by import prices with the rest of the world. So you're kind of back to domestic economies, retail companies in particular, probably, or IT or intellectual property type companies that don't have that import export problem. So if you were particularly worried about it and you wanted to do something, I would avoid export or import exposed industries, to use that horrible cliche. But frankly, I wouldn't change how I was investing. I would say, though, if you are the investor who has a very overweight mining position in your portfolio or construction manufacturing position in your portfolio, I really would reassess that.
I would reassess that anyway.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. So I wouldn't change what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But if I was someone else who had a differently structured portfolio, I wouldn't want to be particularly exposed to miners, to manufacturing right now.
My thoughts tend to be, I get there's a very natural sort of urge to want to act or react when these kinds of things happen. And
what do I do now? What do I do?
What do I do? I need to sitting on my hands is negligent almost, and it's silly. So I get that. But the trouble I have is that the thing with economics, like so many other things, that there are first order impacts
And then there's second order, third order, fourth order. And it is almost, well, it is very much a what a mathematician would call a chaotic system. You know, it's a butterfly theory kind of stuff. So, you know, it is extraordinarily hard, almost impossible, I would say, to look at a impact and then try and guess accurately in any way, say, shape or form, the actual impact and the timing. It becomes very, 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 very difficult. Then you've also got the other dynamic, which is these feedback loops, they feed on themselves as well. So there's what would happen under one set of stimulus, but then one side reacts and another side reacts again. And it could be that we see Trump gone in a couple of years and someone comes back in and undoes it all, or it could be, as to your point, you start going down this rabbit hole of you can have two of the smartest Harvard educated economists in the world with teams of extraordinarily intelligent, well-paid researchers, and they'll come up with very different conclusions, and they'll both be extraordinarily plausible. So for me, it comes back to your point. Well, I'm not doing anything different. I'm sticking to my process, my strategy,
right.
You know, my long-term vision, understanding that I'm investing in a chaotic, uncertain world and just trying to do the best I can under that scenario. And what does that all mean in simple language? Just stick with good companies, buying them at central prices, understanding that it'll be a bumpy ride and that you'll get a few wrong, but over time it'll be okay.
I listen to, that tends to be our response to most things, Andrew. We talk about this on the podcast. When we talk about this beforehand, we say, what do we say now? Just do nothing? But you know, it's true. And I was listening to a very different podcast, actually. It turned to be about nutrition. It was a Big Ideas podcast. And they were talking about, you know, this nutritionist was saying, how do I get on national TV with a great new thing? They want excitement. They want controversy. They want something. Yeah. And my advice is, well, eat sensibly. Eat a varied diet. Don't overindulge.
It's like every weight loss plan you've ever had.
Well, exactly.
Right?
But the ones that get the something diet gets the headlines because it's new and it's different and it's kind of sexy
and a celebrity's doing it, you know.
So. And so, you know, and I guess we would probably draw that parallel. Yes,
absolutely.
You can jump from fad to fad to fad, or you can say, you know what, we know what works. As much as it feels like we're being repetitive, and we are, if nothing else, if we get that through to most of our listeners and say, guys, we get that you want something exciting and new and different and big and right now. The best thing you can do is actually do the sensible thing and let it compound for you. You'll be very, very glad you did.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's talk sport.
Yes.
And let's talk specifically about the AFL. AFL will reveal a record almost $49 million surplus for its 2017 financial year.
That's
it is
nice.
The most profitable sporting code in the country by quite a way. It's actually got an income of $650 million. The balance sheet has $400 million worth of assets or near enough on it. Now, let's put this into perspective.
Now, we should say before you do, luckily, we have an AFL expert here with us. Liam Flanagan, one of the best young callers in the business on the Triple M network.
I was going to bring young Liam in.
Certainly not on the financial aspects of it. That's not something I have to prepare for.
That's okay. We're not experts in finance anyway. So we're on the same
page. All I'll say, mate, is you are in the right game. There is money to be made here. And, well, the AFL makes about $650 million each. Well, they... their top line, their revenue, their sales, $650 million.
Right.
The NRL, $350 million.
Yes. That's AFL's second, almost twice as big.
Second place.
Yeah.
Cricket, $313 mil in revenue. Of that, they only make $50 million in profit. Now, go down to rugby, and these guys are making $3.7 million per year.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that much. Even $120 million in sales. It's a pretty small margin. Poor old the FFA, the Football Federation Australia, a much a smaller code,
or
I suppose.
Soccer, as I like to call it, just to really annoy most of our listeners who want to call it football.
Football for everyone else.
Soccer, come on.
$105 million, but they actually make a loss. They actually lose about $300,000 a year at this point in time. So I guess the first question is this. If I'm one of these, if I'm the league, how do I make money? Where does my money, if I'm the AFL, where does my money come from?
So the first thing we should say, the AFL isn't there to make money directly. It's actually it's supposed to be putting money back into the sport. So to some degree, the profit number kind of matters because it gives them some sort of war chest to kind of keep reinvesting in future years, but their job is to redeploy that cash into growth.
Kind of like an RSL club, right? Like they're not allowed to make a profit, but they should reinvest
that
back into the community.
I love the fact we're trolling our Victorian listeners by saying, it's kind of like an RSL. I love that.
Oh, sorry.
I'm gonna think
before you speak.
I'm gonna lean for a second. Mate, what's your best guess on why the AFL is so profitable?
Oh, wow. Question without notice.
Yeah,
but that's
totally.
No, look, I agree that it's... what some people probably don't realise about the AFL is how much they do prop up some of the clubs in the competition.
Right.
There are some clubs who annually handed millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars by the AFL just to survive. So the clubs themselves aren't super profitable. In fact, I think there's probably only three or four clubs which are regularly profitable. It's a national sport, which has got over both rugby codes.
Liam is bragging here, guys, just so we're all clear.
This is without notice.
Which automatically means it's got access to, you know, more wallets, more hands in pockets, going to games, attending venues.
Right.
It's a bigger audience that samples the product. I also think, and it's not a popular tack that the AFL is taking at the moment, but I love the fact that they are pushing expansion, trying to take the product to China. Port Adelaide's took the first ever game for points to Shanghai last year. They're doing the same again this year, and now there's discussions taking place to take a game to India, which Jeff Kennett is very much opposed to. But the AFL is trying things. They have a great product. It's obviously a financially successful product, but they are not resting on the laurels of that product.
Mate, I reckon that, to my mind, so Andrew, partly to your point and partly in response to Liam, I reckon one of the great things the AFL's done is what we would ask most companies to do, and I think it's actually what the other codes haven't done anywhere near well enough, is to invest in the long term. So you think about when the Swans first turned up in Sydney, or even when Western Sydney then came about, the Lions having emerged with, or the Bears having emerged with Fitzroy, stay in Brisbane. They seem to have made those kind of tough but long-term focused calls to ensure that stuff grew. The NRL's tried it a couple of times. They went to WA, they pulled out. They went to South Australia, they pulled out. It kind of feels like they haven't had the guts, the money, the something to stay the course and really invest like properly in long-term success.
Well, and to that point continuing, Tasmania is a perfect example of the AFL's business strategy, because Tasmania is an AFL state. It is an AFL heartland. They love the sport down there. They don't have an AFL team. They don't have a league team, and they're not likely to get one because it is a captured audience. That audience, there is no there's no new audience to be won there for the AFL. Right, yeah. Whereas Western Sydney, which is where they launched the Giants 5-6 years ago, was a new frontier with brand new eyes and brand new wallets to be won. And so they've spent the money out there, even though it's not a traditional AFL area.
Right, right.
Mate, is it also fair to say too, sport's not my forte, as you two blokes know, is it also fair to say that they get a much bigger share of the female audience, whereas the other sports tend to be very male-dominated?
I think there's definitely the perception being reality. I think there's a very large perception that AFL is a much more female-friendly audience. Again, if you're competing against the rugby codes, it appears less violent, which means they want kids to play. Dads want their kids to play, because when little Tom, Dick and Harry want, or Sally now with the women's code, when they want to go out and keep them involved in sport, they don't want them getting hurt. Yeah. And the AusKick program that the AFL runs nationwide is a very successful program.
Talk about long-term investing, hey? Those young junior programs, that is really smart.
So I think, look, I'll try and wrap this so we can move on. But I think, for my mind, there's a couple of things. Liam was mentioning the national part. And the TV rights are so incredibly important. If you can sell
$2.5 billion broadcast.
Right. So if you can sell the same game in New South Wales and Queensland, like rugby, but also Victoria, Tasmania, SA, WA, and frankly around the world, that's a much, much bigger pool of money for the same game. You play one game once, talk about economies of scale. Yeah. If you can sell that in seven cities rather than two or three, that's a huge, huge advantage. On top of that, I think, to Liam's point again, the schools program, I'm a league and union fan because I grew up in New South Wales. I love my Swans, by the way. Giants are the second best team in New South Wales. excuse me. So I think, when it comes to, AFL have run this business so incredibly, incredibly, incredibly well. They are streets ahead of the other codes. They've invested in the future. They've invested in the kids' stuff. They've invested in women's sport, which is brilliant. Like the AFLW, or WAFL, which one is it?
AFLW.
AFLW, thank you. Women's code is doing so fantastically well, getting massive props, lots of support, lots of team involvement. Like these guys are just, if you're sitting there as one of the other codes looking at that going, why are we not doing this stuff? They are just doing a spectacular, spectacular job. They deserve every plaudit they're getting.
And the other thing I will throw into the mix lastly, and then I'll shut up because I'm hitting out of my zone, is that the next step for the AFL is they now own Etihad Stadium in Melbourne. They have taken back, in the off-season, or I think it was done last year, but they now own that precinct, and you watch what they turn that into over the next 2 years. That will just be yet another massive revenue stream for the coach.
They took on a bit of debt to do that too, but I actually think that's going to be I'm with you. I think that's going to be a very, very savvy investment. So I guess really the take home from there is that sport is a very big business, but it is like any business, it depends how well you run it. And AFL is absolutely top of the pops.
Really good point. And frankly, rugby union should be doing nothing but watching AFL for a year and then going and doing whatever strategies that work there. Yeah. Rugby is just being run so incredibly badly. It pains me to say because I do love my rugby. Just being run so incredibly badly compared to what the AFL's been able to do. It's a real crying shame. Now, before we move on,
okay,
Liam, when can we hear you on the Triple M Network calling football?
Ah, that's very kind of you, Scott. Mm. This, you can hear, well, I'm on Monday to Friday with MG, the Rush Hour with MG, 6 p.m. till 7 p.m.
Spectacular program.
104.9 Triple M in Sydney. If you're in Sydney, otherwise you can grab the podcast via the Triple M app, same place you can grab the Motley Fools
very
podcast.
Good.
But also this weekend, I'm doing GWS Western Bulldogs on the Sunday and Gold Coast Suns versus the Kangaroos on Saturday evening.
Very good.
What's your tip? Who's going to win?
Gold Coast v Kangaroos, they're probably two teams are going to be fighting out for a bottom four spot. I'll say the Suns because they're playing up in Cairns at Kazali Stadium, so the humidity, I don't think it's going to do the Kangaroos any favour. And for the Giants, you've got to go the Giants. I know you're a Swans man. It could be an All-Sydney Grand Final this year, actually.
There we go.
The Giants should be too strong for the Bulldogs.
Thank you, mate. Seriously, I'm not kidding. Liam does a spectacular job with MG during the week and a spectacular job on the weekend. So check it out. If you aren't listening to Liam Flanagan, you are missing out, I promise you.
Very well said.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/triplem.
Mate, let's talk a bit about ethics.
Is this an intervention?
We are really covering some wide territory on this podcast.
I'm just worried it's an intervention. Are you going to tell me I've done something wrong, or is this a lesson in ethics for me or something?
Mate, yeah, the demons will come at night. If you've done something wrong, there's the little guy on your shoulder.
That's not the demons, mate. That's the police. If you knock on the door, it's not the demons knocking.
What are you doing? we really tripped over something here. So I guess
guilty conscience, you reckon?
Without getting way down the rabbit hole here. So ethics. Ethical investing has been this phenomenon that sort of, it's a relatively recent phenomenon where people are basically saying, look, I want to invest. I want to make money. That's the point of investing. Yep. But I want to do it in an ethical way. Mm-hmm. I want to do it in a way that is a net positive for society, not just for my wallet.
Yep.
And frankly, it's something that quite resonates with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually get many of our members often talking about it and asking about it.
Right.
But where it gets tricky is that, and this is why there are whole philosophical departments devoted to this kind of stuff and why it's been debated for decades and will be debated for centuries more, is that it's something that's very hard to be 100% objective on.
Yes. I think it's actually incredible because it is a subjective pursuit by definition.
Yes. So there's great examples out there. So some might say, I don't want to invest in oil companies.
Right.
Because it's polluting, it damages the environment, and you know, they just don't have a great rep.
Scumbags.
And other people might say, well, yes, but it is the engine for the global economy and
that's
brought a lot of good about.
Yeah, go to
the
oil companies.
So you can argue various things in different ways.
Right.
So I guess the question I have for you is, A, are you an ethical investor?
No.
You're not an ethical, you don't care?
No.
At all?
I don't think my wife would let me buy any gun makers or cigarette companies, put it that way.
Okay. If it wasn't for Ruth, you would.
So here's the thing. So ethical investing is really important. I have absolute utmost respect for people who choose to do it that way. Yep. I think that's a great thing to do, and it's all about the individual preference, right? Mm-hmm. And as much as that sounds like a PC argument, that's actually kind of the case.
Yeah.
If you don't want to invest in companies you find ethical, don't do it. That's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that I have is that at the end of the day, if I buy shares, let's say you own shares in Smith & Wesson, mm-hmm. right? The gun maker, I don't know if they're listed, but let's assume they are in the US. Okay. If you sell your shares to me, nothing changes for the company. The shares are already out there. The money's already been received by the company once upon a time when they listed.
Yeah.
It makes absolutely no sense whether you own the company, I own the company, Liam owns the company, or Uncle Bob owns the company.
Mm.
It's the same company doing the same things with the same number of shares, with the same profits. It makes absolutely zero difference. So whether I own the company or not makes absolutely no difference.
It makes some difference. Here's my argument. Oh, my argument would be that the more...
Can we cut this out later, Ant?
The more people who are... I'll not be censored. There are more people
you will.
Out there that have a vested interest, and shareholders have a vested interest, and the more support that they have for that, the greater the premium the shares will trade at. The greater the premium the shares trade at, the lower, not to get too nerdy, but the lower the cost of capital for that company. So for shares that trade at a high premium, they can raise money by selling more shares.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see a company that's trading on a nice high multiple because people are really positive towards that, that's going to enable them to undertake investments that they otherwise wouldn't be able to do. So it actually does help them continue to do what they do And if you're against that, then you know your participation, your support, your encouragement for all of that in an indirect way actually feeds into that. Now, on the other hand, everyone thought this is terrible. I don't want anything to do with it. And the shares trade at a, you know, a multiple of 3 or 4 times earnings. Their cost of capital relatively is much, much higher.
Mm. Do you want to acknowledge you're wrong now or do you want me to prove that you're wrong?
Okay, I'll just depend. I don't know what you're going to say. So I don't want to paint myself into a corner.
Andrew. What is the best performing company on the US stock market over the last 50 years?
I know what this is. This is Altria.
Altria. And what does Altria do?
They make cigarettes.
Oh. Cool. So we move on then.
Let's move on. It's a really fascinating point. And the reason is when you dig into Altria's success, is that rather than trying to fight this very, very huge secular trend of decreasing smoking rates and all of this other kind of stuff, is that they have really avoided reinvesting into the business. Mm-hmm. So they've got these machines, they've got these processes. They're actually really, really quiet. They spend a bare minimum and they are running this thing for cash. And they just haven't needed to raise capital. Mm-hmm. So they've been a wonderfully successful business because they have very, realistic management in terms of where the long-term future is. Yep. And they're not plowing lots and lots and lots of money into that thing to try and make it grow. They're running it for cash and therefore are not reliant on public market capital.
Exactly.
Okay. So, I'm going to give you...
I think you are technically right and there are some businesses
The best kind of right.
Do we write in theory or do you want to make money? There are some companies out there who absolutely do need to continue to raise capital, and to the extent that people avoid their shares, if it's done at a large enough extent, that absolutely can have an impact on their ability to do so.
Yep.
I think, honestly, mate, I think the cost of capital argument, I just have never, ever bought that. Mm-hmm. There's the idea of a WACC or a weighted average cost of capital, and there's lots of algorithmic and arithmetic ways of calculating that kind of rubbish. I was at the Berkshire Hathaway meeting a few years ago, and someone said, Charlie Munger, what's your expectation for weighted average cost of capital? And I said, I have no idea. Our job is to take a dollar and turn it into more than a dollar. That's our only job. Mm-hmm. So I have a massive, massive disdain for any of the academic stuff about cost of capital.
So you're going to take Charlie Munger over me? Let's not answer that question.
Okay, let's move on. I think you're right, and I think there is some tangential benefit to that. And where there are companies that do need to raise cash, you are dead right. Mm-hmm. So there's probably a net. There probably is, frankly, a net benefit to being ethical if you choose to, in the sense that for those companies, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
For those companies, it does matter, then it will actually have an impact. So net, we can both, I think, agree that it does have, by definition, some impact overall. I think it's relatively minor. I think people do it because they want to feel good, and that's great. I think the chance that it has a material impact on the markets, their portfolio, the companies, I think that's relatively small.
So I'm going to disagree with you again. Cool. There's not a big disagreement.
You think you would learn the first time, Lee?
At a high level, you're largely right, for better or worse.
Was that hard to say?
I did choke.
I just want to know if it's better to be largely right or technically right.
Technically right is always the best kind of right. Okay. Largely right is just a concession that you throw Scott a bone every now and again.
Oh, and that was fighting words.
And what I would say is this: there are certain companies out there that operate in a way that might be legal but unethical, and sometimes that can really come back to bite you because you're operating on the fringes here. Something comes undone. Yep. And it's not that it's just that we don't feel good about it or we don't like about it. It gets to a point where people stop buying your product or people stop supporting your service. And then that's when it has a very, very direct impact to the bottom line.
Okay.
Case in point. Facebook was the one you mentioned before.
Yes, sir.
Jim Carrey very famously came out earlier this year, late last year.
Noted investor.
Noted investor Jim Carrey came out and basically said, I'm selling all my Facebook shares.
Didn't say somebody stop me?
What's that?
He didn't say somebody stop me?
No, he didn't. Okay. He didn't. Took me a while to get that.
There
reference.
We go.
and there's actually a bit of a movement around this where people are saying these guys are dodgy in terms of their role in the US election and how they get money and what they do with personal data. Mm-hmm. And now there's ructions in the ructions. European Union about
That's
saying...
Underused word, ructions.
I love ructions. Yes. Ructions. And people, the lawmakers, regulators are now looking at these companies and it is potentially having a very, very real financial impact because of their ethical behavior.
We need to move on, but I'm going to just make a point.
No, we don't. We don't need to move on.
No, because I think you're right, but I think that's different.
Wait a second. You think I missed that line.
Companies that don't manage to operate in a way that society likes is a definite problem.
Yep.
But that's different from being an ethical investor for mine. I can be completely unethical on a personal level and say, I think Facebook's going to run into trouble with lawmakers, therefore I'm not going to invest in it. Mm-hmm. I don't have to have a view on their ethical. Ethical is a value judgment. Mm-hmm. If I'm looking for any company, I'm saying, does Facebook profit? Is it likely to be higher or lower in 5 years' time with all the things that are going to be affected, including regulatory pressure? Mm-hmm. I can make that decision separately. So I'm not investing on ethical grounds. I am including the company's ability to grow or not, be constrained by legal forces or not. Radio Rentals, right? A company owned by Thorn Group. We both recommended it once upon a time. We both sold it from our services.
Thank God sold that.
That was a dog
of a stock.
But here's the thing. So people argue it's ethical. Companies. Some argue it's unethical. I didn't sell it for either of those reasons. I didn't buy it because it was ethical or unethical. I didn't sell it but what I saw was, as you say, people moving away from this, regulatory pressure coming down the pike, just didn't have a future. I think you can do that and say, you can take society's ethics or even regulatory pressure into account without having to say, I'm investing in this because it is or isn't ethical under some other framework.
Man, there's so much to talk about there.
Isn't there?
But we are getting dangerously low on time. I guess the summation here is you should invest in a way that is aligned with your own ethical standpoint, and just bear in mind that there can be real world economic impacts on that.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
I'm going to skip the high horse, mate.
You're not.
I am. I'm going to skip the high horse.
Dear, oh dear.
Because, frankly, that's always a good filler when we don't have enough material to talk about.
Just quietly, I'm not skipping in next week. I don't care how long we go. I get one chance every fortnight to jump on my high horse, and I'm not missing out, goddammit.
Well, we got a great mailbag question. We tried to get to it last week, and we're very quickly going to. I know the time.
You've avoided the short high horse for a long dissertation on someone's question.
I thought we could do this one pretty quickly. And Dave, Happy Singer on Twitter at Happy Singer. Thanks, Dave, for the question. It was a really good one.
Liam, have we ever done anything quickly on this podcast?
Ooh, I'm gonna give Andrew a chance here.
Have you got some Oscars playoff music?
By the way, you're not helping with the time here by saying this.
I bring the comedy, dude. You bring the serious stuff. All right. I want some playoff Oscars music from Liam.
So I'll have it on standby.
There we go. All right.
Okay. I'm doing air quotes as I say comedy right now. And Dave says, I'd be interested in your thoughts on evaluating management. Nigel, that's a great question. I really wanted to get to it last week, so apologies for that, Dave.
Sorry, Dave.
We will dig into it now. Shortish to keep Scott happy. How do you do that? So a lot of the stuff we do, it is in financial statements, it's in annual reports, it's all this kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, you've got people running this business, and the aptitudes, the qualities, the skills of these people are phenomenally, phenomenally important drivers of shareholder return.
Yep.
So as we've sort of joked about before,
they can be.
Well, you put me in charge of Berkshire Hathaway, that thing is dead in 10 years' time. Right, you put Buffett lives for another 10 years, and then it's going to do wonderfully well. So
this locker runs an investment service for Motley Fool.
Yeah, but I'm no Buffett. Let's just be honest. And by the way, do you like my T-shirt?
I do. I'll take a photo after this podcast and we'll tweet it out.
Okay.
Yeah, if listeners, here's a bit of interactivity for you. Liam's doing a great job with Instagram on the Rush Hour with MG. I'm going to try a really, really lame version of that because we don't have Instagram. We have Twitter, which is kind of like Instagram but without many pictures. So I'm going to tweet that out from at the Motley Fool AU. You can have a look at your viewers. Let us know your view on Andrew's T-shirt. Yes or no?
I'm just going to say tongue-in-cheek. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek.
Or is it?
So anyway, how do you evaluate it? Okay, let's go one for one here. I'm going to start off by saying I think skin in the game is a hugely important factor. When I see management that have a significant number of shares, in other words, you know, a reasonable proportion of their personal wealth tied up in the business, I think their interests are highly aligned. And I'd add a little wrinkle on that as well. It's not just about having shares, but I always prefer it when the CEO or the senior executive you're talking about has actually bought those shares with their own money, not just free rights issues that they've been granted. I mean, that still helps. But when you've gone on market and you've bought a reasonable number of shares, you are very much aligned to shareholder interests.
This is a long shot topic, dude.
Keep going.
I'm gonna put a pin in this. One part of this conversation,
okay.
I'll ask you, to say that I actually don't know that management is always as important as people think. Let me leave that. We'll come back to
that. Okay, we'll come back
to that. In terms of evaluating management, next thing I would look at is, and this is obvious, right, but track record. And I think track record, not just over the short term and not even just in one business. You know, trying to work out the difference between a manager who has been lucky because he's invested in a business with a great tailwind. Mm-hmm. If you'd invested in iron ore stocks in 2008 or you're managed an iron ore company, you couldn't do badly for 3 years. You were just, you were a genius, right? Because the iron ore price skyrocketed. Yeah. Any knucklehead with a mine and a dump truck could make money in the iron ore space.
Yep.
If you've done it multiple times in multiple businesses and preferably even across multiple industries.
Yes.
And we'll call that one guy, Bevan Slattery here, who started, bought Pipe Network, started NextDC, started Megaport and Superloop. This guy's a serial entrepreneur so far with really, really good results. So he's doing a good job.
Yeah, I'm a fan.
Look for track record, ideally for a long period of time, and ideally even better across multiple companies or multiple industries.
I really like, as a false positive, I think that's the right term, and the manager that isn't focused on share price. And we often, in our game, we actually do get CEOs reach out to us and say, you know, they'd like to talk about the share price. And in other words, they're charged with running the business, but they're spending, rather than spending, you know, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, working on the sales and marketing team and improving product design, making serious, smart, long-term capital allocation decisions, they're out there talking to analysts, trying to promote their business and why the shares should be worth more.
Yeah.
And that to me is a complete, that is an alarm bell loud and clear, because that shows you where their focus is and it's not in the right area.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I'm going to throw one more, which is candor. And that is management who are prepared to tell you the truth no matter what.
Yes.
When you have a company who comes out and says, this is what's going on, I want you to know. Buffett talks about their investors as partners in the business.
Yep.
And if your CEO is treating you like a partner, there's a very, very good chance you're getting it straight.
Excellent. Mate, let's leave it there.
Before Liam gets the playoff music going.
Some really wonderful...
There we go.
And I'd like to thank our Lord and Saviour. Thank you very much for listening to Motley Fool's Triple M's... I got that wrong. Triple M's Motley Fool Money Podcast. Remember, you can subscribe to us through iTunes or your favourite Android podcast app.
And Andrew, you should.
And you should. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a big fat 5-star rating on iTunes and tell all your friends.
Indeed.
And if you want a bit of extra foolish goodness, you can go to...
fool.com.au/MMM.
Until next time, fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.